True Crime Today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure, until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed, for what?
I'm Tony Bruschi. Welcome to the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts as to not miss any breaking updates on the case and discussions as we have them. You can get a commercial-free experience of the show through Apple Podcasts if you'd like. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Today, we're going to jump into a conversation with Ann Bremner. She's an attorney and one of the nation's most recognized legal analysts. We're going to dive into the Koberger case further, some of the evidence that has been revealed last week through the unsealing of some documents. We're also going to talk a bit about the Brian Walsh and Anna Walsh case, the murder of Anna Walsh, and go into the psychology and what could be going on there, what we're going to be seeing in the coming weeks, months, and behind the scenes as the cases progress. And welcome to the program. The first thing I want to get from you is your insight into the large list of evidence that was released last week in the Brian Koberger murder case, and just get your thoughts on what was found and what some of those pieces may lead to in terms of defense and prosecution.
Analysis is yet on the stains on the pillowcase and the bed and bed sheets. You know, I would say that would stand out to me the most. I mean, it appears to be something that could be later determined to be blood or could be from him.
Sure.
But I think that would be the thing that would stand out to me. An animal hair. As I understand it, wasn't there an animal hair? You know, we've got Murphy the dog, you know, that was at the crime scene. So often in these cases, you transfer of hair, but also animal hair. And so that's important if he's not around pets and you've got some analysis that, you know, shows some similarities to that poor dog that was in the house all by himself, you know, up in a room. And then I think that, you know, I heard one expert say that, well, maybe this is his MO, that he's going to have a defense that I couldn't be that careless to leave a knife sheath or to leave evidence in my apartment, you know, et cetera. I don't know how that works, you know, with this kind of evidence in his apartment. But the fact is he went on a road trip with his dad and went for the holidays, and he would have left all that evidence, you know, behind, mm-hmm. you know, with a PhD that he's seeking in criminology at Wazoo. It's kind of hard to believe that he would be that careless. He would know that they would come to his apartment at some point if they had PC.
Do you feel that maybe he just had such a level of confidence that he thought there's no way they're going to get me or no one's going to come on to any of this?
I think that's a real possibility. You know, from the beginning of this case, I thought two things. Number one, social media had to be connected in some way. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing some evidence that he may have followed one or two of his victims on Instagram. But number two, I kept thinking of Ted Bundy, you know, somebody that was pretty proficient,
sure.
you know, over the years. And likewise, Gary Ridgway, who was the Green River Killer out here, he was good at it.
Yeah.
And he knew it. So maybe that's where this defendant is that he sees himself as almost invincible.
That's an interesting thing. I had seen some interviews with the attorney that was assigned to him in Pennsylvania. And it was interesting because the attorney said he came in, he seemed that he was genuinely shocked that he was caught.
Right.
But otherwise seemed fairly pleasant, which if you're being accused of this, you know, quadruple homicide and they've been searching for you and there's a lot of evidence going your way. What does that say to you as a defense attorney, as having seen many clients over the years and such? When a client is behaving in that sort of a manner and there's that much damning evidence behind them, what does that say?
You know, I've never seen that in my practice, not, of course, to this extreme and level.
Sure.
My ex-husband represented Ted Bundy when he was involved in basic allegations against him here in Washington State and in Utah and in Colorado and even in Florida. And Ted Bundy, apparently, per my ex-husband, John Henry Brown, said he acted in a very similar fashion. Smarter than everybody else, good looking, law student. Remember, he went to law school.
Yep.
And, you know, felt that he was not going to be convicted. In fact, he was offered a plea deal in Florida, as I understand it, with the death penalty off the table. He went into allocute and backed out. And of course, he got the death penalty.
Sure. When someone is acting like that, that they have this air of confidence to them, obviously we're talking about someone, there's some sort of a mental disorder going on here at the heart of all of it. But when they're in that place, talking about the psyche of it specifically, do they believe that they are not guilty? Do they have no recollection of committing these crimes? Or do they still think, I mean, I know I did this, but I know I'm going to be able to get away with it because of their delusional confidence, if you will.
You know, I think it's the latter, and there's some evidence out there, and I'm in touch with an expert I use out here a lot, a psychologist who's talked about the snow syndrome. You know, that basically he's got this detachment, this lack of empathy, that he's got some visual acuity issues where he's before said that I don't feel anything. Mm-hmm. I don't feel for anybody. I look at my family, I hug them, I don't feel anything. So maybe that's what we're looking at with him. And, you know, I think with at least what I knew from the Bundy case, and I also had represented Ann Rule, who wrote The Stranger Beside Me about him, is that he really was charismatic and he really felt that he could play the lawyer. Remember, he represented himself in court, and the judge said, you know, if he'd gone a different direction, partner, I would have been proud to have you in my courtroom, you know. And so there's that too, that there's some feeling, especially if he's, you know, proficient in criminology, like he appears to be via his education, you know, that he feels that he could, you know, go ahead and win all of this. But I don't think he's in a position where he's saying, I didn't do it, or he's saying, you know, they can't show me, they can't, I don't think I did that, or I don't remember. I don't think he's saying that yet.
With all of the social media buzz, obviously, around this story, and I know you just had that book, Justice in the Age of Judgment. How much do you feel that will play a role in the actual prosecution or defense of Koberger when this, or if this does go to trial?
I think, and is pointed out, and I wrote that book with my brother, who is a psychiatrist, and he's done a lot of forensic work too, but you just can't get around social media and media anymore in a high profile case. There's the web sleuths, there's all of the, you know, arguments, there's, you know, the support mail, the hate mail, there's the, people just reading a headline somewhere and then people arguing, you know, about whether or not, you know, there's enough evidence, and other people saying it's overwhelming evidence. And once you get into a courtroom, that's where you hear witnesses sworn, of course, and you have, you know, competent evidence is ruled upon by a judge. Those things can be very different. Mm-hmm. And that's what we talk about in the book. Amanda Knox was convicted and damned before she even went to trial. And of course, she was exonerated at the end. Mm-hmm. There was so much negative publicity about her. I mean, she wasn't just found not guilty. She was exonerated by the Italian courts. That's the word they use, but I didn't have that here. Mm-hmm. And you look at, you know, the cases that I cite in there, cases I've tried myself and covered, where the perception of the case going in is a lot different than the jury verdict going out. And the question is, what happened in between?
Sure. With the Koberger case and us learning more of the evidence that they have yesterday in that unsealing, and what we already know from the initial affidavit, where do you see this going, in your opinion, once we get to June, if we get to June, and they have the hearings at that point in time, and then he eventually pleads? Do you feel that there's going to be so much there that there's really not going to be many holes to poke through from the defense? Or do you see this actually continuing to go forward and his MO being, I'm innocent?
Again, I think it might be the latter. You know, there are some issues here on the DNA analysis, you know, that have been raised. There's also issues with respect to the, you know, tracking and the evidence there. Are there holes to poke there? The one witness in the house, you know, that saw him, heard him, and then, of course, didn't contact the authorities for some time. There's just some of those issues that I've seen raised out there in media and social media. Mm-hmm. We just don't know yet. Yeah. We do know that Whitman County, where Wazoo is, had agreed to publicize the, you know, search warrant inventory. Mm-hmm. There'd been some indication it would be sealed until March, but, or that would be the request. my guess is there's more coming out as we go on the analysis and everything else. And it depends on where that falls. But I think he's going to go to trial. It's a death penalty case. Most prosecutors will not bargain the death penalty. Ridgway here in Washington, who killed 48 women, mm-hmm. they did plead and bargain the death penalty because he told them where the bodies were. Mm-hmm. But that's really unusual and was very controversial. So most prosecutors will say, we're not going to do a plea bargain to take death off the table in a case this horrible.
Would there be any way that that may come to play, though, if he were to explain why he did it or go into greater detail, almost in the same way as BTK did?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. And if you put in mental illness or defect, you know, under the statute definition, that's something to be looked at in terms of, you know, the aggravating circumstances and mitigating circumstances that would play into a death penalty analysis.
There's been some buzz today. We're seeing talking about this could be essentially accelerated if they were to sidestep everything with the stall tactic with taking this to a grand jury indictment. Is that a possibility? And if so, how would they get there to do a grand jury indictment prior to June?
I'm not sure about the grand jury procedure in Idaho. I know they have preliminary hearings. Mm-hmm. We don't use grand juries in Washington in the state system other than what's called an IJ or inquiry judge proceeding, which is a one judge kind of grand jury.
Okay.
And it's something that's optional and rarely used. Preliminary hearing usually means that you go in to test the evidence, just like in the O.J. Simpson trial. They had one in his case, like a little mini trial for probable cause. But I don't really, you know, it's a good question. I'll need to look at that. I don't know how they use a grand jury in Idaho.
Yeah. I'd be curious because if they were to do that, that could spare the surviving roommates from having to sit in court in June and face cross-examination and such.
Yes. Yeah.
Which obviously would be good for them.
Yeah, it is. I understand that at least it's set for a preliminary hearing. It doesn't mean that that's going to happen. At least in Washington, really, when I was a prosecutor, rarely that was used in the IJ, and that was only in cases to kind of test credibility of a witness or something for the prosecution to analyze whether charges should be filed or pursued. Excuse me.
Let's move over to the Brian Walsh case here and the murder of Anna Walsh. Let's talk first about Brian's criminal history. We know about the dealings with the art, the fake art that he was trying to sell, and the ones that he stole from his friends. We know about him stepping into the father's inheritance and basically pointing himself the executor and stealing money there. How much do you think his criminal history, or how much can his criminal history come into play in this case?
With respect to the evidence in court, any crimes of dishonesty or false statement under evidence rule 609, it's A and B, can come into on cross-examination of a defendant on the stand usually. Mm-hmm. And these would be crimes of dishonesty or false statement, especially to the art fraud. With respect to looking at charging him, those are, of course, things to look at, you know, in terms of financial motive he may have, you know, a life insurance of his wife, not having the income from her. I think he looked up whether he would inherit from her.
Yeah.
Things like that. So that would kind of be, they'd look at it more like, what is his financial motive? He had a motive, what was it? And it may have been in part for financial reasons.
That's what we're seeing a lot of. I believe it's almost his fifth or sixth search in the query among how to get rid of bodies is asking about how long does it take to get an inheritance if the person is missing? Not dead, but missing. So I think the thought was in his mind, she'll just be missing. No one will ever necessarily find this. What does it tell you about his character with the fact that police went in and they found so much damning evidence right there in his house, knives in the basement? And this is someone who seems to think he is very smart, just judging by what we've seen and his attitudes and his past. Is this someone who is careless? Is this someone who is just so confident that it's to a fault? What does that tell you?
I think so. I mean, some people have described him as a sociopath, you know, out there in the media and social media. Mm-hmm. But he sure seems confident. He was even being, of course, monitored because of his other charge in terms of where he could go.
Yeah.
You know, $450 worth of cleaning supplies. You're wearing a mask and gloves to buy them. You know, paying with cash. The searches on his computer, many. The how to dismember a body. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the, oh, and my wife, you know, she got on a ride share to go to DC to get on a plane. Well, you know, wasn't her phone in the house or somewhere? Yeah. Not with her.
Yeah. It was all pinging at the house.
Right. So either you think he's the stupidest criminal out there, or maybe he's the smartest. I don't know, but this sure looks pretty damning to me. I think right now, in terms of all of his missteps, it's, you hear one after another, then you hear a new one, another misstep.
I know. It the list keeps going. What I'm wondering, because listening to the friend that had spent New Year's Eve with them, and then 6 short hours later, he's looking how to get rid of her body. And at New Year's, they seem to have nothing going on. There wasn't any sort of weirdness. There was no arguments. It was just a very calm, pleasant night. And then something happened in the middle of the night. What I'm wondering is, how premeditated was this? It looks like he was getting ready or considering getting divorced by some of his search history. But then suddenly, New Year's Day, it goes to getting rid of a body. Do you feel that this might have been just something happened? He snapped. He did something to her, killed her, pushed her, did something, and then had to get rid of the body?
It could vary. The evidence suggests that, although in 2014, she'd posted kind of a cryptic description of a wound she had in her eye that looked like she could have been a victim of domestic violence. And given that, that may have escalated to where he killed her. But the fact that he's leaving so many clues and it appeared to happen suddenly could be that could have been he snapped, they had an argument, and he overreacted, etc. He could say it was an accident, you know, but then after the fact, I had to do all these things and search all these things because I was scared, you know, that she died in an accident, but I had to get rid of her body. I had to cover up, but that doesn't mean that I had premeditation in killing her.
It's almost like a manic, you know, oh my gosh, I did this. I have to go fix this very quick. And then which you end up having many missteps, which appears to what he did. But what gets me a lot is when you see him in court and you see his smirk, his smile, almost as if he's sitting there ordering a beer at an Applebee's. It's what he looks like. What is that? How do you, let me ask you this. How do you, in your work, when you would represent someone, a client, and maybe you've had one like that or something like that, when you have one, someone who has such defiance to reality or just the magnitude of the charges against them, whether they're guilty or not, how do you handle a client with that type of an attitude and that type of an appearance publicly?
You know, I've been up against people like that representing victims and civil and criminal. And so I've usually, for example, Josh Powell and Susan Cox Powell case was like that. Remember, he was believed he killed his wife, and then he killed his 2 sons later in the case I had.
Sure.
That you use it against him. I don't know how you control somebody like that as a defense attorney, because he's not controlling himself. I mean, he did all of these things, and he still thinks he can go forward with impunity. So, and that somebody, any lawyer, should win his case. That's how he looks in court. Like, of course I've got this, right?
Sure. There's such an air of confidence that it almost feels like he either knows he did it and he doesn't care one bit, or he's believing that, well, this is all just an error and I'm going to get out of here soon. And that's why I'm acting this way. I don't really care. Obviously, it enrages the public and enrages a family and anyone that cares about the victims of him. But it's just such a disturbing way to present oneself, almost to the point where I was evaluating earlier on the show where he is. Obviously, they're just labels, psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, and all that. Psychopath is kind of where I've been landing a lot of times with the lack of empathy, the lack of not even seeming to know right and wrong, or having no regard for it. Sociopaths sometimes can inch into that. Sometimes there can be a little bit of regret after the fact. This man doesn't seem to show any whatsoever after the fact.
I know. I know. And when you look, I mean, he just blithely went and sold fake Andy Warhol paintings.
Yeah.
You know, like, of course he can do that. You know, he had this whole thing with his father's inheritance. Yeah. And now he's looking at his wife's inheritance, at least online, how to get it if she's missing. You know, he doesn't have any remorse from what I can tell, including when he appears in court. all eyes are on him, and he just smirks and, you know, has kind of that blank look on his face, like, what?
With something like this in the future, where if this goes to trial, with this much damning evidence against him, and I would say from the outside, as just a person over here talking about it every day, it seems like there's much more damning evidence in this case than the Koberger case, even with the search history, with the weapons being found in his house, the back of his car with the tarps. Where do you see this one going? Is this something where it's likely to be a plead out and not get the death penalty? Or would something like this that's so, so damning and so obviously guilt is going to be the reality here? Do you see it going to court? I know he's pleading not guilty right now, but do you think this will end up in trial?
It's hard to say because this is a no body case.
So far,
Susan Cox Powell case that I mentioned was a no body case, and Josh Powell was never prosecuted. He killed himself and his children long after she disappeared, but they all believed he killed Susan, but there wasn't a body. And so that gave them pause, and they didn't charge that case at the time that Josh killed the children. There are no body cases. There's even a website out there called nobodycases.com, I think it's called. So I think I got in touch with that person back when I tried the Cox Powell civil case. And, you know, that they can be won. But look at this. Maybe the family wants to know where she is.
Yeah.
Maybe they want more answers. And he may try and plea bargain that and say, you know, I'll get a life sentence or life without parole, and I'll tell you where she is. That could be a possibility. I just don't know. But that's something that where you can't find the body, that the family sure wants her to rest in peace. They want to find her and put her to rest finally.
I was surprised to see him being charged with murder so quickly. Were you, or is that typical? Because there is no body. And we're only on January 19th, and this happened around the 1st. Was it just so evident to prosecutors and such that this is a murder by his search history and the evidence that they had, that they knew it was a murder and there's probably not any chance of her turning up, as to why they made those charges?
Well, you summed it up beautifully. That's exactly what they have. And when they read out the evidence in court, I mean, it was just chapter and verse.
Okay.
So they feel confident, and they wanted to make sure they were holding him on murder. They had those other charges, remember, but they wanted him on the homicide.
Is having a body, how important is having a body in a murder case?
Well, it's very important, you know, because you don't want the jury, there's that old, you know, story where they don't have a body, and then they say to the lawyer, says to the jury, watch, so-and-so, the victim's going to walk in that back door. All the jurors look over, reasonable doubt, they could still be alive. So, you know, that fact lends itself to reasonable doubt. On the other hand, there's, like I said, a lot of no-body cases over the years that have been charged, and circumstantial evidence is as valid as direct evidence. She's not seeing her kids. You know, she would never leave her kids.
Sure.
She's making no transactions financially. They're going to have, we'll see what they have in terms of DNA and blood evidence, and also analyzing the other items, you know, potential murder weapons in the case. And then a search here at history, you put that all together, and the jury could find that he did it, even though no one could find her.
Obviously, he's not going to be getting the kids back, at least anytime soon.
No.
I know they're in Child Protective Service custody. Where do you see those kids ending up? Is this something where they could end up with family members, or are they going to be into the system, or where do you feel that will go?
I sure hope they end up with family members. What a horrible thing. They're very young, and it's just a tragedy that they're going through this. Hopefully you don't want them in the Child Protective Services custody for long, or even in the foster care system. And there's wonderful foster parents, but it's better if they're with their family. And again, with the Susan Cox Powell case, those children, I represented the grandparents, the parents of Susan, and they wanted to take those kids. And they had real difficulty, you know, getting those kids because the father was alive and not charged. But here the father's alive and he is charged.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, a family member would be so important. I also had a case out here years ago where a husband killed his wife and the kids went to family immediately, and it was a transition that was terribly difficult, but also a lot more seamless than going through the system.
Ann Bremner, attorney and one of the nation's most recognized legal analysts. Thank you so much for joining us on the program, sharing your insights and opinions. If you like the program, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Don't miss any breaking updates and conversations on this case and more cases as we begin to discuss them here on the program. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me online at Tony B Pod. Until next time, for all of us at True Crime Today, thanks for listening.